Good afternoon. My name is Desmond, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the HUD's Radon Mortgage Policy and U.S. Radon Standards and Policies conference call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you. Ms. Purvis, you may begin your conference.
Thank you, Jasmine. Welcome, everyone. My name is Bethann Purvis, and I'm going to give you a brief introduction to using the webinar controls. Before we get started with that, I just would like to make sure everyone's accessed the call-in information, 855-637-8650, and our conference ID is 646-90853. So to begin, in the upper right-hand side of your screen, you will see the webinar console. Use the buttons on the console sidebar that look like fast forward and rewind buttons to maximize and minimize the console. By pressing the button with the square inside, you can also maximize or minimize the webinar presentation on your computer screen. At the bottom of the Maximize console, you will notice the Questions feature. Use this to type in any questions you may have during the presentation. You can maximize or minimize the questions pane by pressing the plus or minus sign next to it, and you can pop it out of the console into its own pane by pressing the triangle button. As you heard earlier, because of the large number of participants, we have muted all attendee lines to control the amount of background noise. If you have a question or problem during the webinar, please use the questions pane to communicate with us. Finally, you may notice a mouse moving during the webinar. We apologize if this is distracting, and we will do our best to minimize it. I'd like to now turn the webinar presentation over to Peter Hendrick, the Executive Director of the American Association of Radon Scientists and Technologists. Peter?
Thank you, Bethann. Welcome, everybody. The presentation today is being done in conjunction with HUD, US EPA, and the American Association of Radon Scientists and Technologists. We're excited about this. We want to provide you with an overview not only of the multifamily policies as they relate to radon that go into effect June 4th, 2013, but also with some background on radon infrastructure standards and policies. Presenting today for the Department of Housing and Urban Development will be Hillary Atkin, Environmental Specialist at HUD headquarters, William Long, Director of the EPA's Radon and Indoor Toxins Program, Sean Price, the President of the American Association of Radon Scientists and Technologists, and Kyle Holman, who is an ARST board member. ARST is the acronym for our organization, and also a mitigator who has some experience in multifamily testing and mitigation. Again, I'd like to reiterate that at the end of today's presentation, we will have a question and answer session and provide, again, instructions for how you can ask those questions. Next slide, please. Today's overview will really cover several areas, what the HUD multifamily mortgage radon policies are. We're going to give citations on radon risk and some of the goals and priorities of the U.S. government since the passage of the Indoor Radon Abatement Act in 1988. We're going to give you an overview of the radon certification and licensing infrastructure and organizations involved with standards and implementations of rules and standards throughout the United States. An overview of radon standards, particularly how they relate to multifamily standards, and an overview of regulated versus the non-regulated states in the United States. At the end, we're going to give a brief synopsis, really qualified application of certain standards, how certain multifamily buildings designs come into play. The entire presentation is not meant to be in depth, but to give you resources that you can go to at a later date, and so that you know which organizations to ask for regarding standards or regulations or licensing or certification. Next slide, please. Radon is a radioactive gas. It's found all over the United States. We want to give this brief synopsis so that we're clear on the danger here. It's a naturally occurring radioactive gas. It has no color, odor, or taste, and it comes from the radioactive decay of uranium or radium in the soil, rock, and groundwater. It emits ionizing radiation during its decay process, and we call those radioactive isotopes radon decay products. Radon gets into the indoor air primarily from soil under homes and other buildings. It's non-discriminatory, and in many cases, you cannot, in practically all cases, you cannot identify a building that will be impacted by radon just by looking at it or determining what the soil is. Radon's a known human carcinogen, and it's the largest source of radiation exposure to providing risk to the general public. So that's a brief overview on what radon is. I'd like to turn the program over now to Hillary Atkin, who is the environmental specialist at the Office of Housing at HUD headquarters. Hillary, take it away and introduce the next speaker when you're done. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. Well, probably good morning for some of you. I just want to reiterate, if you have any questions, please write them down, save them for the end of the presentation. We will be sure to address them. And if you would prefer to just contact me directly after this is all over, you may also do that. My contact information will be at the end of the slides, and I'm sure most of you have it anyway. Let's move on to the next slide. What I want to do today is give everyone a general overview of the policy and try to anticipate a few questions that you may have, and also answer some questions that I've already received from you all about the policy. So the meat of this policy is the requirement for a radon report. A radon report is required for all MAP and TAP applications, unless an exception applies, and we will talk about the exceptions later on. A lot of the questions that I've been getting surround the 223F exception, so I will make sure to get into that. The radon report must be included in the pre-application or application, whichever one applies to that deal, as an addendum to the environmental report. And as far as content for the radon report, we're looking for results of testing, mitigation details, including timing, as in when that will occur, and if any post-application testing or mitigation needs to take place, those need to be amended to the radon report as soon as those occur. So as you can see, this is similar to our remediation requirements in that all testing and plans need to be given up front with the application, and then after actual remediation takes place and follow-up testing, those details need to be appended to the original report or that report be amended. Okay, next slide, please. The radon report must be prepared by a radon professional, and we define what that means within the policy. Basically, what a radon professional is someone who has certification from ARST, the American Association of Radon Scientists and Technologists, through their National Radon Proficiency Program or the National Radon Safety Board. In addition, if the mitigation is taking place in a state where the state has a license or certification requirement, that the radon professional must also have that license or certification. The radon professional must supervise all testing and mitigation, and I'll talk about what you want to look for to have that assurance in a little bit. Okay, next slide, please. Let's talk about the exceptions to the radon report requirements. And just to be clear, what these exceptions mean is if the project qualifies for it, they don't have to submit the radon report, but they may need to provide a justification within the regular environmental report. So generally, which could apply to any transaction if there is a valid justification outlined by a radon professional that can accept that project from the radon report requirement. And what we mean by a valid justification is something that would indicate that there would be no need to do radon testing, such as an open air garage on the bottom floor of the building, so that radon risk would be dissipated by the presence of that open air area. You know, and as we get in further into this policy and people start to submit justifications, of course, we will help you with determining whether it's valid. But the word and experience of a radon professional is a very good indication of whether it is. Another exception, which is arguably the most complicated, is the 223F exception. And the general idea is that 223F projects in low-risk areas do not have to submit a radon report or perform any testing. And the way you would determine whether that is a low-risk area is to look to the EPA radon zone maps and any available local maps or data. Now, I've already had several questions on what some of these things mean, so I've included those in bullets and I'll explain them further right now. If there is no local map or local data, it is okay to rely on the EPA map. If you're looking to check the validity of the local data or map, it is okay as long as it's a government-sponsored map or set of data. And when we say readily available within this policy, basically what we mean is that it's available on the internet. You could also have to go to the radon professional could also have to go to the local government agency to get the information, as long as that's not, particularly onerous for them to do. Okay, our next exception is for 223A7 transactions. No radon report is required if the proposed project is under 223A7. Now, where the radon report is not required according to these three exceptions, we are still encouraging testing. And if the borrower elects to do testing and mitigation, it needs to be done as described within the radon notice. Okay, next slide, please. Okay, so when you get this radon report, you're probably all wondering, what should I know and what should I look for to get some sort of assurance that it was complied with? And so I'm going to give you some ideas for that. As far as the testing requirement, you need to make sure that the appropriate standard is referenced, which is the ANSI ARFT MAMF, M-A-M-F 2010 or 2012 standard. 2012 is actually the latest version, so we referenced 2010 in the notice. You also need to make sure that a radon professional supervised the testing and prepared the report. And what you should find within the radon report is a statement that the radon professional has the proper certifications and licenses, that they prepared the report, and that they supervise any work that went into the report. The next thing I have here to look for is that at least 25% of randomly selected ground floor units were tested. This should also be a statement within the report. And when I talk about, when I say this should be a statement in the report, we do plan, this group that's giving this presentation here today, to discuss what you guys need to see within the radon report with the industry and lenders. So they will have some notice that we're looking for specific statements and certifications beyond just the radon policy. Another item to look for in the radon report is that if there are testing results above 4 picocuries per liter, which is a measure of the radon, mitigation is required. And when I say if there are testing results above 4 picocuries per liter, I mean any testing results. The standard is based on only 25% testing. So if there are results above that level, mitigation of the building is required. In addition, resident notification is required. So if there's a testing in existing building, the residents would need to be notified. And if there's mitigation in existing or new building, the present residents or future residents for new would need to be notified. Okay, next slide, please. Ooh, go back one, please. There we go. Okay, some more details on what to look for in the radon report. As far as mitigation, again, make sure the correct standards are referenced. If it's an existing structure, so it's a 223F transaction or sub rehab or conversion, you want to see that the ASTM, you want to make sure that the ASTM E2121-11 standard is referenced. That's the standard for mitigation of existing structures. Now, ARST also has a standard for existing multifamily structures, which radon professionals are free to use. We do still want to see the ASTM standard referenced because it's kind of the minimum standard, and it is a standard required by our policy. So we are considering the R standard to kind of go beyond ASTM to address more multifamily building specific issues, but the report must still reference the ASTM 2121. The reason we don't have ARST in the policy at this time is because it's a provisional standard, and once it's final, we will be considering it and possibly incorporating it into the policy. The other standard, as far as mitigation, that you'll want to make sure is referenced for new construction is the ASTM E1465-08A standard, and that is the only standard available that addresses mitigation in new construction buildings. As I pointed out earlier, the standard is to mitigate the building. It's not for unit-by-unit mitigation. Sometimes mitigation for radon is done on a unit-by-unit basis, but that is not what we're looking for with this policy. So we want to make sure that that has happened, and that should be a statement within the report. Once again, for mitigation, there would be resident notification of that, whether it's an existing building or new construction. And you're going to want to look for post-mitigation testing. So any mitigation that takes place would be necessarily followed up by testing according to the standards that we reference to make sure that the mitigation was done appropriately and effectively. And then at the end of the whole process, you're going to receive a certificate of completion, and that will be appended to the radon report once testing and mitigation is finished. So you will need to look for that. Okay, next slide, please. So what I've discussed so far is kind of a general discussion of what to look for in the reports, the references to standards, et cetera. What I want to talk about right now is some more of the meaty requirements that are more the concern of the radon professionals, but I want you all to know about it in case there are questions, and so that you have a good idea of what the radon professional is doing and what you will see within the report. Okay, so for 223F transactions, a few requirements are that the testing must have been done within a year of application submission. So this is similar to our ASTM Phase 1 requirement. The testing cannot have been done any earlier than a year before they submit their application to HUD. There are a few exceptions to that. We've already discussed one, the special exception, where, of course, they don't have to submit any readout report and thus have no testing. Or the property owner can actually elect to proceed directly to mitigation and not do the initial testing. And as I discussed earlier, mitigation for 223F transactions will at least meet the ASTM E2121-11 standard for existing buildings, and that mitigation must be completed as quickly as practicable, but no later than 12 months after initial endorsement or initial closing. Okay, next slide, please. For sub-rehabs and conversions, testing is actually required in all radon zones, so this is a difference from 223F. Testing as a 223F must occur prior to application and must be performed no earlier than a year prior to that application. A few scenarios that can come up here. If testing is not feasible before application because there will be change changes to the building envelope such that it wouldn't work to do testing before those changes, the owner is to proceed directly to mitigation. When that is done, testing will occur after construction and must take place before final endorsement. And if the results of that testing reveal levels of radon that are above that threshold level, that for 4 picocuries per liter, retrofit mitigation will have to be done. And the standard for that is also ASTM E2121-11. Next slide, please. For new construction, so in general, all new construction requires radon-resistant construction built in. But depending on the zone, it may be different. So for new construction in Zone 1, passive radon-resistant construction must be built into the project according to ASTM E1465-08A, which is that new construction standard. If the new construction is in Zone 2 or 3, it must meet the gas permeable layer, ground cover, and foundation wall requirements of ASTM E1465-08A. So basically what we're talking about when we say radon, passive radon-resistant construction, and these other items are just varying levels of intensity, I guess I would say, and mitigation. And whether they have been effective or not will all be confirmed by post-mitigation testing, and additional mitigation may be required. So as I just stated, post-construction testing is required. And if it's above that threshold, for Zone 1, an active mitigation system must be installed. And for Zone 2 and 3, a passive system must be installed. So as you can tell just by the sound of the word, the active system is a little more aggressive, I'll say, than passive, and needs to be used in Zone 1 if the passive system does not adequately address the radon levels. As we talked about earlier, residents must be informed of the testing and mitigation that took place. Since this is new construction, they would be informed after the fact, as opposed to informing testing in existing construction before it takes place. And as with some of these other requirements, mitigation must be completed by final endorsement or final closing. So my next slide actually says questions, but since we're not taking questions to the end, why don't you take some time to write down any questions that you have so we can address them later on. And the next slide is my name and contact information. Please also feel free to write that down and contact me at your will with any questions about the policy. Thank you. Our next speaker is Bill Long. He's the director of the Environmental Protection Agency's Center for Radon and Air Toxics.
Great. Thank you, Hillary. Next slide, please. Yeah, thank you everyone for joining the call. I just wanted to say a few words mainly in support of this effort. This is a great webinar. We're happy to help make it happen, but we're mostly here to listen to ARST and HUD talk about the implementation of this new policy. So I have a few slides here I wanted to go through, mainly just to tell the story about how big of an issue radon is and how much EPA is behind reducing exposure to radon and preventing lung cancer. It's very well established. It's a non-controversial issue. We estimate that thousands of lung cancer deaths each year are caused by radon. About 13% of the lung cancer deaths nationally are attributed to radon. That means they would not occur if it weren't for radon exposure. This is very well established. It's been through all of the agencies' scientific review, and it's based on National Academy of Sciences research. Next slide, please. We estimate that about 21,000 cancer deaths a year are caused by radon exposure. That might actually even be higher now because that was based on housing data from the 90s, and there's more houses now. It's probably counterbalanced somewhat by a decline in smoking, and smoking and radon do have a synergistic effect. If you smoke and you are exposed to radon, it's an even worse problem. This is why we're so thankful to HUD for their efforts to try to reduce exposure in multifamily housing where smoking rates are higher than in the general public. It's, as I said, not a controversial issue, not just EPA, but the NAS, the Surgeon General, many other groups, government and non-governmental groups, have gone on record to state that radon exposure is a serious threat to health and needs to be addressed. We have what we call an action level for radon. Hillary mentioned this in her presentation. And we recommend that people take action at 4 picocuries or above. And we actually recommend that people consider taking action between 2 and 4. There's no safe level of radon. And in fact, that 4 picocurie level is actually quite high in comparison with lots of other countries around the world. And the World Health Organization has fairly recently set a lower level than the United States. Let me make sure. That's really my last slide, but I just wanted to say a few words. Just want to let everyone know that EPA is behind radon. We have had some budget challenges over the last year, but we remain very committed to the issue. We have a number of resources that we invest in the issue. We have a large state grants program that does have money in FY13 going to states around the country. We have a laboratory in Las Vegas, Nevada. We have another one in Montgomery, Alabama, that provides some support to states and industry with regard to radon and provides a technical underpinning of the program in terms of intercomparisons with other countries. We put out guidance to the public, to the general public, about radon. We invest in the creation of standards and codes. Those standards and codes are form the basis of this new HUD strategy, this new HUD policy. So we're very thankful that these codes have been developed with the help of many external stakeholders. We do outreach to the general public, and including media campaigns, to just try to raise awareness about the issue. It's a tough environmental issue to get people to care about, but we are making progress. So I just want to mainly say we're very much behind the radon issue. We're not going away. We're very, very appreciative of HUD's work, as I mentioned. One of the things we've done over the past couple of years is to reach out with our federal counterparts to try to ramp up, increase radon action. And HUD has been a very, very important part of that. They really have taken a big step with this multifamily policy. We think it's going to have a major positive health impact around the country, and it's going to create a lot of other action. I'd also like to thank ARST in particular for their efforts to have a focus on quality radon testing and quality radon mitigation. That's something we at EPA believe in very strongly. We, in fact, used to run a program to list qualified radon measurement professionals that measure for and mitigation professionals as well. That has now been privatized, but ARST has continued to stand for quality radon testing and mitigation, and we can't stress that enough. It's an issue that you need to have done right, and that's why we're thankful for this webinar to get the word out about how to do it right and protect the people living in the housing. And I guess that's my last point I wanted to make before I turned it over to Sean, was just a thank you to everyone in the HUD stakeholder community for paying attention to this issue. We know it's a new requirement, but we also believe that this is going to have a big positive health impact, and we thank you for your willingness to implement it. This new policy is going to save lives. It's the kind of thing with radon exposure. It's actually radiation, as Peter mentioned, and you can calculate how much risk is reduced when you take care of it. And we know that by this new HUD policy, there are going to be less people who get lung cancer, and that's a great thing. Lung cancer is a terrible disease. It's has a very low incidence of survival beyond a few years. I would bet that many people on this webinar right now have had their family touched by lung cancer, and this is a great way to reduce the misery that comes with this disease by reducing the exposure to radon. So just wanted to briefly say thank you to everyone involved in this effort. And at this point, turn over the mic to Sean Price. Sean Price has been a leader in the radon world for many years, and he's currently serving as the president of ARST. Sean.
Hey, thanks, Bill. I am the current president of the American Association of Radon Scientists and Technologists. I'm located in Western North Carolina, and the presidency is an elected position, and it's a two-year term, and it's a volunteer job. But in my spare time, I actually help to run a major radon laboratory here in Western North Carolina, and I entered the radon industry back in the late 1980s as a contractor to EPA. So next slide, please. Okay, yeah, Bill mentioned the privatized radon certification process. EPA initiated the very first radon certification back then. It was called the Listing Program for radon laboratories and analytical providers. That was started in 1986. And they ran the program for about 12 years, and there were some, again, back in the 90s, we had some budgetary obstacles that we were having to dance around. So there was a decision to privatize the proficiency program. And out of that privatization effort, two programs were created. One is now called the National Radon Proficiency Program, NRPP. When it was begun, it was being done as a National Environmental Health Association program. So in some documents on some websites, you may see references to NEHA-NRPP. That program now is under the full oversight of ARST. So now you may see it as either simply NRPP or ARST-NRPP. And the second program that was created through privatization is called the National Radon Safety Board. EPA's laboratory, as Bill mentioned, in Las Vegas, is still involved. They are kind of the what we call our national standard. We all know that the National Institute of Standards and Technology, NIST, kind of is the agency that creates, our standard measures in the United States. The EPA Las Vegas Lab, which is known as Radiation and Indoor Environments National Lab, at one time did hold NIST traceability for the measurement of radon 222, and I believe it was a NIST decision that they no longer do that. But the EPA laboratory still maintains all of the processes and procedures that it took to obtain its traceability. And the radon measurement devices that are used in the United States need to be approved for use by either the NRPP or NRSB. So what that's doing is it's making sure that the device can be used in different environments, different temperatures, different humidities, different amounts of radon, and still produce accurate results. And the approval process is very stringent, but it is also designed for those devices that can and will be used by radon professionals. To get into the radon credentialing programs, to either get a license or your certification, requires coursework, entry-level exams, and then to maintain, you know, those credentials, one has to take continuing education. You have to have your devices calibrated. There are performance tests, so those people that are quantifying the radon concentrations do have to pass, you know, tests where devices are physically put in radon chambers, and they have to measure within the acceptable limits. And there are also quality assurance and quality control requirements that are also built into some of the requirements. Next slide, please. Speaking of the quality assurance and quality control, you know, we do have to have calibrated equipment and calibrated laboratories so we can have defensible, repeatable, and accurate radon tests. So the EPA Las Vegas laboratory does an intercomparison with other radon facilities, and the two that are, we call them secondary chambers, that are used for proficiency testing. One is maintained in Colorado Springs and another one in Dayton, Ohio. And there may be other, you know, device manufacturers or other facilities that do their own calibration, but ideally what they have a link back to either Bowser Mourner or Radon Measurements Laboratory, one of the two listed here, who then have a link back to EPA. So we're looking for that second or third layer of defensibility back to EPA, and that way we all agree that this is 4 picocuries, that chamber says it's 4 picocuries, and another chamber says it's 4 picocuries. So it all keeps us kind of on the same page. Next slide, please. Okay, you've already heard the name and our acronym, ARST. We are the private sector trade association. We are a IRS 501c6, which is a trade association. We're a member membership organization. There's also another organization, Conference of Radiation Control Program Directors. These are combinations of public and state programs. So a lot of the radon programs at the state level are members of CRCPD, which is shows their website there. And then, of course, we've got the two national credentialing programs, the NRPP and the NRSB. Okay, next slide. Okay, when we break out the state programs, we typically call them either regulated states or non-regulated states. You know, here we've got them as voluntary and regulated. Now, what that means is they don't have the authority to directly regulate or certify the radon testers and mitigators. They don't have their own credentialing program. But what they do have is a reliance on the national programs. And so what we see is when we go to a state radon program's website, you can find people that are credentialed in those states, and typically it's a combination of the lists from the NRPP and NRSB. There are a couple states that have additional requirements on top of just having, you know, your credential. For example, are you helping with data collection? Are you coming to their continuing education programs? Have you not had a myriad of complaints waged against you? So there are some voluntary states that don't simply anybody and everybody that's passed the credentialing, but for the most part, you know, they do rely on the voluntary programs. Now, there are a couple states that you will not find state radon offices. Maryland and New Hampshire, they were closed. Maryland was closed 20 years ago, their state radon office. And the state of New Hampshire's program was closed from funding issues a couple years ago. And there were a couple states, Virginia and California, that lost funding for a period of time, but have resumed back in the radon awareness programs. And then we've got the regulated states. This means that they do have some level of authority to either administer their own program or to require that professionals go through one of the national programs. And sometimes it's a combination of both. Sometimes you take the national exam, but then you come back and you do some state-specific requirements. So we do have, you know, a good number of states. They usually have slightly different requirements from each other. So there's not like a common set of requirements that all 15 states have. So when you're dealing with a state, we need to make sure that we understand the specifics and the dynamics that that state has, because it may be very similar but slightly different from a neighboring state. Okay, next slide. And the radon standards, originally EPA wrote radon protocols. When they created the radon program back in the 1980s, there were no sets of standards or protocols for testing and mitigation. So the initial documents that were published were done by EPA. And since that time, we've moved more nationally into consensus-based standards, and that's, you know, from what I understand, across many federal agencies, not just EPA, that consensus-based standards are now the preferred vehicle. So we have two developers that produce radon-specific standards. ASTM, of course, everybody's heard of ASTM, and then in 2004, ARST created the Consortium on National Radon Standards, and since that time we have gained accreditation by the American National Standards Institute, and so we are a recognized standards developer. Okay, next slide. Okay, now radon standards specific to multifamily housing, you see some of these in your policy documents there. Of course, we've got ASTM E2121, which is, you know, for mainly it's for single family mitigation. It does have applicability in many multifamily structures, but that structure complexity may begin to go outside the direct scope of E2121, but there's a lot of good basics there. And then, of course, E1465. That Hillary mentioned a few moments ago is the new construction standard. And then we have the ARST protocol for the multifamily testing, which is a full ANSI accredited standard. And then we have a provisional standard that covers radon mitigation standards for multifamily. And this was only the third provisional standard ever granted by the American National Standards Institute. It is going through some additional vetting now. It's just gone through a public comment phase. We're incorporating those public comments, and it's likely to require one additional or at least another public comment period based on some of the comments received the first time through. But it's a good standard. It moves into some new territory, and I can go into some of those a little bit later, but I'm not going to go into much detail on that. Next slide. Okay, the multifamily standards are really a subset of a larger collection of standards. We've got, you know, the ASTM standards for single family and mitigation testing in mitigation, excuse me. But in the ARST consortium, we also have some testing standards for radon measurement in homes. We do have a new construction standard that was written as a code-ready document. We also have our version of a mitigation standard, but we have decided not to compete against E2121. Rather, we are looking to harmonize those in future updates of E2121 to incorporate the consortium's mitigation standards. And then many of the EPA protocols for radon measurement still exist. There's a major one called the device protocols. That's more of a technical document that the consortium is working on a replacement for. But in the wider scope of radon standards, we do still have and rely on some of the EPA protocols that were originally published back in the 1980s. And then we've got the new construction standard, of course, which has already been mentioned. Next slide. Yeah, just to you know, reiterate one more time, we do have, this is the full standard name, the protocol for conducting radon and radon decay measurement product measurements in multifamily buildings. That is the MAMF standard. And then we've got the provisional standard. The sources, there's a URL down here. I'm not sure how well that shows up, www.ars.org/bookstore.shtml for anybody that wants to order copies of the standards. Okay, next slide. All right, stepping back to some of the states that do have programs that are credentialing their testers, their mitigators, their laboratories, you see the list on the left. These are alphabetic of states that have, you know, pretty much full programs. They may also use the national exam, for example. They may also use some of the national continuing education courses. And then we've got some programs here on the right that use more of the national programs, where you go get your national credential and then you bring back, and you know, that's what gets you through most of your entry requirements. Okay, next slide. When we're in a non-regulated or a non-licensed states, as I've already mentioned, you know, the NRPP and the NRSB credentials are used in the marketplace as the people that have shown competence. They've shown the technical ability to go, you know, at least to understand the minimum standards. And these are very consistent with the original EPA radon proficiency program that was, or as it was closed on 1998. So we have tried to maintain, you know, a higher standard and even try to improve upon the program that EPA handed over to us in 1998. However, in these states, it's not a requirement that you have the credential. So there are the ability for non-certified vendors to operate. So we want to make sure that, you know, the credential and your policy does need to be verified. Just because, you know, they hang a sign on the side of their truck that says they're a tester and a mitigator, you know, it's ideally, you know, to make sure that they have gone through the credentialing process and are currently credentialed. We also recommend seeking those that are experienced, properly insured, you know, possibly bonded vendors, and that they're following all of the recognized standards, which is, you know, directly related to your policy there. Okay, next slide. So just to review, you know, your vendor qualifications. Number one, they need to be state licensed when operating in a regulated state, and they need to be certified by either NRPP or NRSB. You'll find that some states may have some additional levels of credential that may be required to do this type of work, the multifamily type of work. And we give an example here of Illinois, that they have basically an added-on credential for commercial work, and I do believe that they interpret multifamily work to require that added credential. So, you know, make sure that whoever's checking on credentials, that they understand the requirements of the state that the property is located within. And we also recommend, you know, just like you're hiring any contractor, anybody to work on your vehicle or roof your house, you know, make sure that they've been around, that they have a good track record, that they understand the differences in a multifamily structure than maybe a single family home, people that have done school work, Department of Defense housing projects, other large building projects. You know, there have been a lot of testing and mitigating in apartment complexes and condominiums around the United States. So there are those that will already have that experience and have been doing that for a number of years. Again, we want to make sure that they're properly insured to be taking on these larger, more complex projects, and that they not only know where the standards are and know them by name, but they actually understand them and can follow them. Okay, next slide. Now, all of the credentials that I've listed so far, with the exception of Illinois, are pretty much single-family residential-based. That's because that's the original protocols that were put out by EPA and that we've had in our industry for many years, are really concentrating on single-family homes, maybe duplexes, townhouses, and things like that. So right now there isn't really a place to go and say, okay, who are these people that have that added level of knowledge? Well, within the ARST NRPP program, we are adding new credentials based on these new standards that we have published. So we are going to hope to have a listing available and the process available by this coming October, where we can show which testers and mitigators have shown the increased proficiency and knowledge of tackling the more complex structures that are often confronted when you're tackling a multifamily project. So we're probably going to have minimum experience requirements. There's going to be specific training and exams to the new standards, the multifamily standards, some design capabilities, maybe some previous experience, things like that, previous drawings. We're still working on some of these requirements. And then we've got more difficult diagnostics when you're trying to tackle a larger building to understand the radon entry and all of the pressures within a building. It's just a little bit of a more complex beast. So we're going to try to build those in as well. And we're going to have a list that's going to show those contractors and testers that have, chosen to get the add-on credential. Okay, next slide. Okay, just there's a little bit of clarification. There in the HUD policy does mention the MAMF 2010 standard. Now, to understand completely what that standard calls for is testing 100% of the ground floor units, as well as 10% of the units upstairs on the upper floors. And the reason we've done that is experience has shown that radon is pretty pesky at times. It can find its way into areas of the building that we didn't think that it could, either through building materials or chases, elevator shafts, things like that. So our standard is more of a complete do it once and you'll be able to characterize the radon in the entire building. But we do understand that the HUD policy does mention a minimum of 25% ground floor units. This will miss some radon, and the modeling is kind of a tricky thing. We've looked at a lot of data over the years, and to really do a random test model to get a 95% plus degree of accuracy, we would really probably need to test a minimum of 80% of the ground floor units. But that's just for information. The only way to truly know would be to hit them all. Next slide. And just going back to E2121 for a moment, this is the workhorse. You know, this is the standard that talks about the size of the pipe, the type of material for the pipe, where you're going to exhaust the pipe. It is a very solid document, but it is a little bit limited on some of its applications in the more complex multifamily buildings. And so there is a good starting point there, but in some of the buildings, it doesn't quite cover it, which is why we're so excited to go through and finish the radon mitigation standard for multifamily buildings, because it's breaking new ground. Long-term risk management plans, management plans of to make sure we're not exposing the occupants in the courtyards and in the surrounding area of multifamily. So we look for that probably in the next few months. Okay, next slide. Yeah, I've kind of talked on this a couple times already. The provisional standard is out there. It's pretty darn good, but it's going to be going through and getting fine-tuned here over the next few months. And when we're done, we look forward to presenting that to HUD and hopefully working it into the next version of the policy. Next slide. I would like to turn this over. Kyle Hoyman has seen some of these more complex challenges in some of the multifamily, and he'd like to talk about some of his experiences and help to share some of maybe some of the complexities that we might not see in a single family home. So, Kyle?
Thanks, Sean. As Sean said, my name is Kyle Hoyleman. I'm based out of Louisville, Kentucky, or better known locally here as Louisville. I am a Arts Board member, and more pertinent to this discussion, I'm a partner in a environmental consulting, remediation, and construction company that has experience with hundreds of multifamily testing and mitigation projects throughout the region in the United States. I was asked to participate to provide some specific scenarios, and what I've chosen to do is take four areas. I'm going to give you the most common testing scenario that you're going to come across in my experience in the field, keeping in mind that the perspective that I'm coming at this from is from the Fannie Mae Freddie Mac multifamily seller servicer guide, which is somewhat similar in that some of the challenges that are going to arise with your 25% minimum and some of your policy considerations are going to be similar. So I think that these four scenarios will come up frequently. So I'm going to give you a testing scenario, I'm going to give you a mitigation scenario, a policy for ongoing operation and maintenance, and then just a few other things that might come up from time to time. Next slide, then. So, when we talk about testing, by far the most common occurrence that you're going to have arise in the field will be a scenario similar to this. The graphic is a building depiction that we see every single day, hundreds of thousands of these things across the country. This would be an 8-unit. You'd have 2 duplex units on the end with 4-plex in the middle, separated by 2 breezeways. So you have 1 roof, or you could have 3 roofs. At the end of the day, this is classified, though, as a building. You have 3 separate foundation areas, though. So from a radon contractor standpoint, you really have 3 unique challenges. And the challenge is, how do we accurately assess the radon potential in the building? So 8 ground floor units, 3 areas, 1 building. If we use the minimum HUD policy of 25%, of the units tested, let's just say that we do that. We put a test in Unit 5 on Foundation 1. We put a test in Unit 3 on Foundation 2, and they come back at 3.1 picocuries per liter of air and 1.8 respectively. So we have 0 units that tested below 4 picocuries. The question is, does a radon problem exist in the building? And the practical answer to that is, we don't know. We don't have enough information because, as you'll note, we didn't place a test in Foundation 3 at all. Radon is very local. It's based on preferential pathways into the building, and it's quite common to find that you could, in fact, have one of these units, 4 or 8, that could, in fact, test for elevated units of radon. So from a policy consideration standpoint, we would say that you really need to have a minimum of 25% of every foundation area contained within that building in order to achieve your minimum sample size. And, of course, 100% of all the ground floor units would be best practice. So that is something that we deal with multiple times each month in working with lenders, property owners, and managers, and that's a clarification of, do we have a problem here? Next slide, please. From a mitigation standpoint, let's look at a 12-plex. We've got 12 units. In this case, we tested 100% of those units. We had 3 units come back above 4, so we roughly had 25% on that ratio. The next common scenario is, well, which one of these really needs mitigated? Are we mitigating the unit, or are we mitigating the building? And our reference point would be, and Hillary alluded to this earlier, the approach is to fix the building. So in this case, we don't want to create a situation where we're changing potential pressure differentials within the building or pressure differentials beneath the building with respect to the indoor air portion of the building, because we could, in fact, take an approach where we fixed a unit and caused another unit, which was not previously elevated, to have an elevated reading after the fact. So that comes up frequently. You know, again, I'm using the Fannie Freddie as a perspective, but I know that a lot of lenders cross over that, that from a seller servicer guideline standpoint, they're writing on both paper, and I know that you're going to have this scenario come up as you start to implement this policy out in the field. So, you know, again, best policy here, best practice is whenever a single unit in the building tests above 4.0, the approach is to always fix the building, not an individual unit. Now, that's not going to make some of the property managers and the building owners happy, but at the end of the day, from a liability standpoint, that's really what's in the best interest of the residents that are living in the units within the building. Next slide, please. So we've tested the building. We had a problem. We fixed the problem. And in this scenario, we had 12 buildings that were successfully mitigated. We've issued the final clearance documentation to your client. What ongoing operation and maintenance items are required? We're starting to see this issue come up a lot more frequently. A lot of this is created by some of the new vapor intrusion, man-made chemicals, toxic chemicals, chlorinated solvents, things like that's being adopted across the country, and it's now finding its way back to radon land. And the question is, what do we need to do ongoing to make sure that these systems, in fact, do what they were originally benchmarked to do? Keep in mind, as you're working with other remediation programs, installation of a radon mitigation system is really a permanent addition to the building. So it's not something that we're going in and we found TCE or PERC under the building and there's a remediation plan, and 5 years down the road, the site closes, the vapor intrusion system comes out and goes away. These systems, just because of the way radon derives from uranium, those systems are going to be in for the life of the building. So we really need to take that life cycle into consideration from an ongoing O&M standpoint. The ASTM guidelines really don't address this, but the ARST provisional guidelines do, and that would be requiring a long-term risk management plan, and at minimum, the plan really needs to have an ongoing inspection and maintenance schedule. So to give you an idea of what that might entail, you may choose, or the building owner, property management company, may choose to work with a contractor to come in, train the maintenance staff on site. What are you looking at? This should be done on a monthly basis. This should be done quarterly. Kind of developing that plan. Here's the vacuum readings. Here's what to do if this changes. And then following up with an annual inspection from the remediation contractor. And then the other thing to keep in mind is geology changes, pathways change. Just to give you a specific example, I mentioned I'm in Louisville, Kentucky. We handle a lot of work for the Department of Defense down at Fort Knox. We have some buildings where they are close to the artillery range, and we can fix a building, and a year later, we go back and benchmark that building, and because they've blasted and blown everything up next to the area that we're in, we have to tweak and fine-tune the building itself because the pathway itself has changed. So obviously, that's not going to be that crazy in most of the areas that we deal with, but it's also just underscores the importance of regular maintenance as well as regular testing. EPA recommends a minimum of every 2 years that those buildings be retested that would have mitigation systems in, just to make sure that something crazy isn't going on. So we would recommend that you take a look at Section 12 of the RMS guidelines for multifamily and maybe pull out some of that long-term risk management plan and use that as a directive in your day-to-day field operations. Next slide, please. And finally, just a hodgepodge of things. I know that some of you are from in the Northeast, some from the Southwest. Just our perspective on what's out there, other policy considerations. Alternative mitigation techniques may be required. Right now, by far, most common approach is active subsoil or subslab depressurization. That means we're creating vacuum underneath the foundation. The old adage, the solution to pollution is dilution, applies in some instances. When you have larger structures, which is not uncommon in multifamily buildings, you may choose to dilute or positively pressurize the building through energy recovery or heat recovery ventilation system. You're going to find some of that guidance within the RSTANSI radon mitigation standards. HVAC influence. We're talking about pressure differentials within the building envelope. So if you take a large multifamily building, and that multifamily building may be older, where we have a centralized heating and cooling system, it's not uncommon for those units to have fresh air makeup. And it's also not uncommon to go in and find that at certain areas or certain times of the day, because of the pressure differential caused by the dilution or the fresh air makeup, you're going to see radon levels go way up and way down. Now, we see this more often in schools where they turn off fresh air of an evening, but you can see some of those types of trends in multifamily as well. So you're going to need to take some of that into consideration or be reliant upon your contractors to do that for you. You get down into the southeast part of the country, Florida, emanation from concrete, the limestone slurry used in some of the high-rise areas in Florida. I know that there have been elevated radon levels found in Florida as high as the 34th floor of the building. So, again, regional variance is something that you need to keep in mind. One of the other scares that came out a few years ago was the story about radon emanating from granite countertops. Just keep in mind that you have some areas of the country, just like Chinese drywall, for example, where you're going to have different building materials that can emanate radon, and you'll need to keep that in mind as you take those areas into consideration. You go into the northeast part of the country, a full 30 to 35% of all mitigation in the northeastern part of the United States is due to radon in water. It's not typically an issue in most of the other parts of the country, but it is fully a third of the challenge that you're going to deal with up in the northeast, and that is how do I address radon? What's different methodology? There's standards that are out there, but there's not a mainstream consensus-based industry standard that I'm aware of, although I know that there are several groups that are working on that. And then finally, I'll leave you today with non-interference agreement. Hillary mentioned notification to tenants. And the reason this is on here is we had this just happen. It was actually in one of your projects, a HUD project, here in my state, Kentucky. We were called out to do testing. And when we arrived, the building manager said, "We're ready for you. We have instructed all of our residents to have all the doors and windows open prior to you arriving, and they're supposed to keep them open throughout the test period." And we said, "That's interesting. That's the exact opposite. Who told you this?" And we were told that the development, the manager, the builder, the property owner had relayed this information. We actually took a step back and disqualified most of these units from testing, but it was interesting that one unit that we went into, the resident, was upset. And he was upset because it's been a little chilly here, and I've kept my unit open for the last 2 days, and now you guys are coming in here and you're telling me that I need to close everything up and maintain that for 12 hours. Well, it was 38 degrees last week and it's 84 degrees this week. Last week on one of the units closed, and this week now you've got them all back open. You're all messed up and vice versa. So one of the things that I would encourage you to be aware of is that a lot of misinformation is out there. A lot of misinformation is going to remain out there until your policy has a little more life behind it, longevity behind it, and it's not uncommon to run in to those challenges. One of the things that you might consider is just adopting a non-interference agreement to go along with your tenant notification requirement, and I would definitely suggest that you have some type of canned tenant notification language as well. We work with a lot of clients, and oftentimes radioactive radon is a bad word to them, and they like to insert things like slightly elevated, things like that into their documents. So it might be nice for future consideration in your policy just to adopt, hey, these three specific language items need to be in the policy. So hopefully that sheds a little light on some of the challenges you're going to run into. I would encourage you to use ARST and EPA as a resource. These folks have been doing this for more than 25 years, and someone somewhere has encountered whatever challenge you're dealing with, and we're here to help. So please reach out, connect with us, and let us share our experience with you as we assist you with getting this policy implemented. That wraps up the actual webinar. I'm going to turn it back over to Pete Hendrick, and I think we're going to go right into the Q&A section. Peter?
Thank you, Kyle. And thank you, everyone, for staying on. If we could just have the next slide, I'd like to remind the HUD stakeholders, the appraisers and environmental officers who are on the call, that we are making available the R standards, and that download link in your email will remain open through the end of this week. You can download the PDF of the standards. It's available at no cost. It's a single source license, meaning your office. Please don't distribute it. We cannot provide the ASTM documents because they're under copyright, and we do, of course, sell the full documents to practitioners and other interested parties ourselves. Here is a list of the organizations, the websites, and we will archive this broadcast and also post it on various websites. We are about to establish frequently asked questions on the ARS website that are specific both for the stakeholder group here today and also lenders and developers, and that will be posted up, frequently asked questions. But I would like to turn this over now to the conference telephone operator to instruct us once again on how to ask questions. We will certainly ask them, and feel free to email us as well, and we'll be following up with trying to answer your questions. But Jasmine, if you could instruct us once again on how to initiate questions, and I will try to direct them to the right potential answer or answerer.
At this time, I would like to remind everyone, in order to ask a question, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster. And there are no audio questions at this time.
Okay. Well, everyone, I would like to thank you for attending this afternoon. We will be providing, as I said, frequently asked questions on the ARS website. We'll try to post that on radonleaders.org. And certainly you can contact us either through our websites or I'm sure, Hillary, you will take questions from your constituents as well. So if we have no questions, I'd like to conclude the webinar. Thank you very much. If the presenters could stay online, please, that would be great.
Thank you. This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.